You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at media coverage of Ukrainian refugees. Our guest makes the case that many reporters are creating unreasonable distinctions between refugees from Europe and from countries like Syria and Afghanistan. Now, volunteers help keep Wisconsin parks and trails open and accessible for visitors around the state. The Wisconsin State Park System has a new volunteer impact system that makes it easier for volunteers to discover new opportunities across a variety of skill sets and public lands. Janet Hutchins is the Friends Group and Volunteer Services Coordinator for the State Park System. Janet, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. I'm so glad to be here today.
Can you tell us, what is this new volunteer impact system?
Well, we're really excited to share this new opportunity and volunteer system that we launched in late February. That is a new and easy way for volunteers to find opportunities and sign up. It offers a variety of ways to search by property name if you have a favorite property you're looking to volunteer at, by county if you're just looking for one area in the state, the type of property you're looking to volunteer at. And those are just a few ways that you can find volunteer opportunities with this new system.
We've got a link to that system, by the way, at WPR.org/Central Time. Janet, how important are volunteers to our state park system?
Volunteers are critical to the Wisconsin State Park System. They make a world of difference to our mission of being able to enhance and protect our natural resources. With millions of visitors visiting our properties, they play a critical role in helping visitors enjoy their visit when they arrive, enhancing the natural habitat by helping us control invasives and planting native plants, and helping our facilities and grounds stay in great shape. And then in addition to that, we have a lot of volunteers that help us with our programming, and they help offer programs to introduce people to our natural habitats, share the story of the land, and teach other people how to engage in new recreation activities like hiking, camping, fishing, so that all of our visitors can thrive and have fun outdoors.
If people are thinking about volunteering, what kind of time commitment could they expect?
Good question. We have volunteer opportunities, I think, that offer something for everyone. We have short-term opportunities like volunteer work days that happen year-round, but especially coming up this springtime as we get ready for the busy summer season with camping, trail maintenance, invasive species control, as garlic mustard emerges. So these are opportunities that you can sign up in the new system to drop in for a few hours of volunteer work and then stay and play and enjoy the property for the rest of the day. But in addition to that, we have longer term volunteer opportunities where you can stay at the property as a campground host for a few weeks to a month and sometimes longer to help greet campers, provide information about our facilities and education programs, or maybe serve as a naturalist or a nature center host, providing natural history programs and hikes and learn to recreate programs. We also have volunteers at our Visitor Services Center. As they arrive at the property, visitor service volunteers help greet our visitors and hand out information. And then we also have property maintenance volunteers who help us with our building and grounds and keep them looking nice and clean, and help us with things like invasive species control and trail maintenance. We also have another program called Adopt a Trail, similar to the Adopt a Highway program, where volunteers can sign up with a group and come out a few times a year to help monitor a segment of trail and monitor for hazards and do some light trail maintenance.
Talking to Janet Hutchins from the Wisconsin State Park System, looking at volunteer opportunities in our state parks. Now, you also work with Friends groups, Janet. How do people get involved with those? What do they do for their local parks?
Yeah, our Friends groups are a really valuable component to our program, and that's a great way to volunteer if you're looking to get involved with a group and not volunteer independently, but getting involved with a group that is already on the ground and has activities planned and plans fun events at the different properties. We have 64 friends groups to choose from that support a specific property. So you can go online and check out our parks web pages for friends groups and see which groups might be near where you live.
I know a lot of us are pretty connected to our state parks in Wisconsin already. When you talk to volunteers and friends group members, what do you hear from them about their connection to the parks now that they're not just visiting, but actually getting involved in them?
Our volunteers are really passionate about serving at the state parks, and they share their time and talents in jobs that fit with their passion and their interests. And they're really excited about helping us provide more opportunities for our visitors and help improve the parks to offer more recreation opportunities and facilities. Our friends groups do a lot of fundraising where they build new shelters, help put in new campground, fire rings, picnic tables, all types of ways that they help enhance the park. And it helps them feel good, stay active, and get outdoors, and gives them a true sense of well-being.
And Janet, you mentioned there are year-round opportunities to volunteer, but spring is, it kind of makes sense, the busy season. Are you in need right now? Do you need a lot of people signing up over the next couple of few weeks?
Yeah, we do. If you take a look at our new online system, you'll be able to see the different volunteer opportunities, either the individual ones that I spoke about, or we'll be having some spring cleanup days coming up, and they'll be listed online as well. So you can take advantage of that and drop in and help us for a few hours, and then go and play in the park and find some recreation opportunities that you love.
Janet, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Janet Hutchins, Friends Group and Volunteer Services Coordinator for the Wisconsin State Park System. She was with us today highlighting the importance of volunteers for Wisconsin's parks and trails. We have a link to the online volunteer resource where you can find opportunities near you. We've got a link up at WPR.org/Central Time. That's WPR.org/Central Time. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about language.
The United States is a nation of immigrants, and the pressure to assimilate can be great. Some people are compelled to speak English and leave other languages behind. Here's contributor Eric Dregney with a look back at his own family's relationship with language.
Those traitorous Scandinavian languages. Don't be suspected. My grandparents spoke a mix of Norwegian and Swedish, or Svorsk, as it was known. They used it mostly when they wanted an unintelligible language to keep secrets from the grandkids. How I wish they'd passed on this language to me! Being second-generation Scandinavians, they wanted to keep their distance from their immigrant parents, and their thick accents, and their old-world ways. I used to believe this. I thought that the old language fell into disuse, and immigrants wanted to learn English. This perpetuated half-truth doesn't tell the tale of government agents spying on Scandinavian and German meetings looking for socialists or anti-war activists. Settlers spoke English as a matter of self-preservation, and any dissension was deemed unpatriotic. My grandfather told me he could only speak Norwegian when he entered kindergarten, and then would get in trouble since he didn't know English. How could he? I begged my grandfather to teach me Norwegian, but he warned me, "We're in America. We speak English. It's better that way." Clearly, he was scared of something I didn't understand. Then I discovered that some state governments set up a Commission of Public Safety during World War I. Its purpose, to root out those deemed untrustworthy. It was mostly Germans, and Scandinavians by default, those with mixed loyalty who could be considered traitors. These commissions employed virtually dictatorial powers to distribute pro-war propaganda and to restrict activities it considered hostile. These government agents infiltrated meetings and rallies to make lists of radicals and slackers, as well as just plain foreigners who lacked enthusiasm to go to war. Because it was wartime, those who questioned could be locked up indefinitely. These commissions posted notices that read, "Don't be suspected. Use American language. America is our home." This is why my grandfather was afraid. But apparently, the story was not unique. A young Swedish boy in Ashland, Wisconsin, during World War I said, "We never speak Swedish on the street. Olaf was roughed up by some of the Yankee boys in a restaurant last week." Because Scandinavian languages are somewhat similar to German, anyone caught speaking them was viewed as having foreign sympathies and possibly a spy for Kaiser Wilhelm. Of course, it didn't help that the pro-Hitler German-American Bund set up Camp Hindenburg in Grafton, Wisconsin in the 1930s to help young German kids become good Nazis. Up until the World Wars, immigrants often had little incentive to learn English, since most daily business transactions happened in their native language. Jim Jensen, a TV newscaster from Kenosha, said, "If you went to the Danish Brotherhood, you spoke Danish. At church, the services, the sermon, my confirmation ceremony, all in Danish." Churches and social organizations tried to retain their language, although they were on the lookout for infiltrators. Many would begin conversations in English and then slip into their native tongue once they felt safe. Many churches switched services to English to show loyalty to the U.S., but mostly to avoid suspicion. One Lutheran parishioner joked, "I have nothing against the English language. I use it myself every day. But if we don't teach our children Norwegian, what will they do when they get to heaven?"
Eric Dregney teaches English at Concordia University in St. Paul. He's the author of several books, including Vikings in the Attic, In Search of Nordic America. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Coming up, a representative from the Arab and Middle Eastern Journalists Association says the news media should be careful of bias when it comes to reporting on refugees and how they describe refugees from European countries as opposed to the Middle East or Asia. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, journalists covering the war in Ukraine have brought attention to the plight of refugees fleeing the Russian attack. But there's been some criticism over some of that coverage, specifically when correspondents make distinctions between Ukrainian refugees and those from Iraq, Afghanistan, or Syria. Our next guest group has raised concerns about a number of statements by journalists. Here's one example, CBS News senior foreign correspondent Charlie Daggett reporting the first weekend after Russia invaded Ukraine.
But this isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan, that has seen conflict raging for decades. You know, this is a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose those words carefully too, city where you wouldn't expect that or hope that it's going to happen.
Mona Iskander is a producer and on-air correspondent for commercial and public media who's reported on a range of topics in the Middle East and in the U.S. She's a founding board member of the Arab and Middle Eastern Journalists Association, AMIJA for short. AMIJA released a statement on February 27th, a few days after Russia began attacking Ukraine, responding to coverage of refugees. Mona, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. It's so great to be here.
We heard that clip there from CBS, just one of many on your list of examples. Can you talk about the concerns you have when you hear those kind of distinctions made?
Yeah, sure. So, We released this statement last week, as you said, and we listed a few other examples, and they were a range of print and television reporters who were out in the field, some of them in the studio, and they all seemed to be, you know, sort of unprompted, casual, spontaneous statements, conscious or not, that revealed a very obvious bias. You know, as we just heard Charlie Daggett saying, relatively civilized, relatively European. You know, by calling Ukrainians civilized, what does that mean? Are they more worthy of sympathy and coverage than others? And so it was really troubling to us to see these reports coming out. And so we came together as an organization. We've been around for 16 years. We have about 460 members around the world. The board, we're a very active board. And we said, you know, we really need to come out and say that this is just not acceptable.
And your concern isn't the coverage of Ukrainian refugees in and of itself, but it seems like there's a worry that if the language is used in that way, it could potentially do harm to refugees from countries that don't meet those journalist criteria of of civilized, I guess. What do you worry about the spillover effect?
Right. So, I mean, just to be clear, this is in no way to say that Ukrainians under attack don't deserve the resources, the coverage or compassion that they're getting. I mean, absolutely, we stand with the Ukrainian people. But to, you know, for reporters, for journalists to come out and make these comparisons that are really just not correct and that are misleading, it misinforms viewers. And I think it really takes away from the story. You know, some other reporters, you know, they talk about that these are Europeans leaving in cars that look like our cars. So there's sort of this implication that these Ukrainian refugees are not like those other refugees in the Middle East or in Afghanistan who are used to these sort of things. And so, you know, we just thought that was just not acceptable, and we needed to say something about it.
Let's bring on a caller. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hello.
Hi. I mean, I think we're seeing this in more than just the media. I think we're seeing that in the citizens of the world. People are willing to donate more money, open up their homes, you know, give money to Airbnb for places to stay, which is wonderful. But you don't see that happening when it's refugees from Syria or refugees from Iraq or Afghanistan. So the media really seems to be reflecting the population.
Lisa, thanks for the call. I know your organization focuses, Mona, on the media. Do you worry that the media could reinforce that distinction that Lisa's worried about?
Yeah, I think that's a valid concern. I think, you know, we're focused on the coverage, but, you know, you see it also on the policy on the ground. I mean, there are, you know, in neighboring countries, the refugees are being welcome, whereas refugees in other parts of the world that previously wanted to enter into Europe were denied. And, you know, so I think she has a very valid point there.
Thanks for that call, Lisa. Mona, do you worry about when you see coverage of refugees from Afghanistan or Iraq, referred to in that clip we played there, or Syria? How do you see them being talked about compared to what you see in the pieces that you raise concern about?
You know, I think that there's a sense that, that people from the Middle East, refugees coming from Syria, Afghanistan, it's almost as if they're used to this. They're used to war. They're used to wartime. They're used to disruptions in their lives that would force them to have to flee. And, you know, that's just patently false. And it's bad reporting. And, you know, we're really asking journalists to do their jobs. And we're asking for newsrooms to diversify, because when there's more diversity in the newsroom, then there are more voices and the coverage just becomes much better and more nuanced. And so I think that, you know, there's a multi-part solution to this. And it really starts with the newsrooms. It starts with the journalism schools. But yeah, I think it's just not fair to be putting Syrians or Afghans in a different category, that they somehow deserve the situation that they're in.
Talking to Mona Iskander from the Arab and Middle Eastern Journalists Association, a journalist herself, looking at how the media talks about refugees from Ukraine as opposed to Afghanistan or Syria or Iraq. Mona, has your organization got a response from any news outlets since you put out this statement late last month?
Yeah, so, you know, after we released the statement, we received a barrage of media requests from all over the world. And we actually decided to translate the statement into Arabic, Farsi, French, Spanish, Italian, so that we could get this out, you know, further out into the world. I know that, you know, the reporter from CBS did issue an apology. And I know from a source that an Al Jazeera English anchor actually lost his job. But we haven't received, you know, we haven't received directly anything from the media organizations. But look, I mean, the fact that we're even talking about this right now, the fact that there has been so much outreach from different places in the world, print, podcasts, you know, television, it just tells you that we're in a place where people are listening and people care about this. And when they see a double standard, it resonates with people who just see that as unfair.
Do you have suggestions for reporters, editors, producers over how to check themselves and make sure that they're not talking one way because this is Eastern Europe and another way because that's the Middle East?
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, I think first of all, look, I think for reporters or producers, whether you're in the field or not, look around you. Who are the people that you're working next to? Is there somebody that has, that is well versed in the history of a country? Is that person of Arab descent or, you know, Iranian descent, or can kind of help navigate a territory that isn't familiar to you? So I would say definitely look to colleagues, but also, you know, call up experts, call up, you have to vet experts as well. So you have to know where to go. But I mean, we as an organization, for example, we aspire to creating guides for journalists for certain areas of the world. We had a guide for Palestine-Israeli coverage earlier this year. And we are hoping to do more and more of these so that we can also be a resource for media outlets that, you know, when there's a huge event happening in the world and they're throwing reporters into that story, that we hope that they would look to us to sort of help them navigate unfamiliar territory.
Mona, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
That's Mona Iskander, producer and on-air correspondent for commercial and public media. She's a founding board member of AMIJA, the Arab and Middle Eastern Journalists Association. We talked to her today about concerns over racial and cultural bias in Western news media's coverage of refugees, making distinctions between those from Eastern Europe and those from the Middle East. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, state lawmakers passed a new data privacy bill for Wisconsin. We'll find out what it does and doesn't do. We'll have a co-sponsor of that legislation on the show, plus an expert on our online information and who has access to it. And get along to get ahead. Don't rock the boat. Good advice, right? Wrong. That's according to the author of the new book, Insubordination, who has suggestions on when and how we should push back against the conventional wisdom at our workplaces and beyond. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we look at the rising cost of rent around the state and how it affects the lives of tenants in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, civilian casualties are mounting in Russia's war against Ukraine. We'll look at the latest developments with an expert on armed conflict and foreign policy. First, rent is rising around the United States. According to the real estate firm Redfin, the average rental listing sits at almost $1,900 a month. That's up 14% from last year. Cities like Miami, Austin, and New York are being hit the hardest. But Wisconsin renters are seeing monthly costs go up as well. Rents have increased by as much as 10% in some communities. We'll talk about why rent is higher than usual, how it's affecting renters, and what kind of help might be out there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your experience with housing. Are you struggling to find a place in your price range? Do you see rent going up in your area? Is the housing you can afford safe for your family? If you rent to people, what kind of things are driving costs up for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Andy Height is the Housing Policy and Program Manager with the Wisconsin Community Action Program, or WISCAP. Andy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me here on public radio.
Can you give us a sense, Andy, of what renters are facing here in Wisconsin? What kind of things are you hearing from people?
It is a multifaceted, burgeoning nightmare for a lot of people, Rob. The American Recovery Plan Act and other pandemic relief programs have allowed up to 18 months of rent assistance. And it's been a very generous program that covers back rent, up to 3 months forward rent at a time, utilities for water, gas, electric, even internet. But we are in month 24, month 25 of the pandemic. So people that were really deeply impacted are running out of months of assistance, or they've run out, and you combine that with the eviction moratorium expiring, and the wave of rent increases that has been occurring since approximately August and is now settling into people's financial reality, we've got a truly imperfect storm that people are facing.
I've seen a lot of factors nationally leading to these rent increases. What are you seeing drive the acceleration of rent in Wisconsin, Andy?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things. There's a major shortage in permanent affordable housing everywhere in this state for people at the lowest income. A, B, you know, capitalism is a thing. Landlords want to make profits. Their taxes and expenses are going up. They're raising their rents above the rate of inflation to, I don't know, continue to maximize their investment in many cases. So the city of Green Bay has seen 10% rent increases. Winnebago County, the apartment association there is reporting 30% rent increases. In Appleton, it's 31%. I was working with a disabled man up in Oshkosh. His rent went from $570 a month. New owner bought his unit. His rent is now $840 a month. That's more than his monthly SSI payment. Not sure how we're going to maneuver. There's the faith-based community used to fill a lot of gaps in the safety net. And because of the fairly generous amount of public funding, it's taken some pressure off those faith-based resources. But behind that reality is a wave of need that's going to overwhelm the faith-based and private sector funding that could fill the gaps when these program eligibility months start to wane for people.
Talking to Andy Height, Housing Policy and Program Manager with the Wisconsin Community Action Program, or WISCAP, looking at rent increases all over the country, including here in Wisconsin. You can join us if you have a story to share as a renter, a would-be renter, or someone who rents out housing yourself. What are you seeing when it comes to rent prices around the state? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Rebecca is with us in Green Bay. Rebecca, hi.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, I am just calling. I wanted to share a story. I have been living in a duplex for 2.5 years now, and single mother with two kids, and knew my lease was coming up and just called the landlord and said, just wanted to make sure you were looking at renewing. And he did let me know that he was planning to renew the lease, but he was raising the rent by $500.
Raising the rent by $500, not to $500, by $500.
No, by $500, a 33% increase. And he had nothing to say about it other than, I have to make money.
Rebecca, what's your plan now? Are you looking for another place? Are you going to be able to pay that higher cost? What's next?
There is no way I'm going to be able to pay that higher cost. And we have desperately been looking for the last 2 months. And it is really one of these, it's sort of like trying to buy a house right now. There is very little available. And when something does become available, there are multiple applications that are coming in. And I have a fairly good income, but they're just flying off. That to be able to find one is next to impossible. I'm looking for 2 months and still haven't secured anything.
Rebecca, good luck. And thanks for sharing your story. Andy.
I mean, Rebecca, I empathize with the horror of that situation. I mean, $500 a month, I would be surprised if the property taxes increased $500 in a year, even with an increase in valuation of the property. $500 a month is, pardon my awful math, but isn't that $6,000 a year increase? I wonder, and there isn't much housing stock, but is there a first-time homebuyer program that might fit? Can the Community Action Agency in your neck of the woods, NUCAP, provide some case management assistance in finding housing? When I said there was an imperfect storm, Rob, there are a lot of people who would be buying homes that are locked out because of a lack of homes for sale on the market and the incredible upward trend in the pricing of homes on the market. So they're sitting in apartment units and there just aren't available units. I thought I heard that Wisconsin is lacking 118,000 affordable units across the state. And when I talk about affordable housing, I'm talking about people from 0% of the median income to 30% of the median income, but it's just as bad up to 50% of the median income. And we're seeing thousands upon thousands of households that are rent burdened, where they're paying well over 35% of their income, sometimes more than half their income for rent. And it doesn't take much of a disruption to teeter on the brink of financial ruin because wages just aren't increasing commensurate with the cost of housing.
Rebecca, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Chris joins us now in Wabino. Chris, hi.
Hello, yes. I'm Chris from Wabino, and I'm trying to keep my rent down. I haven't raised it any of my renters, but just the sheer price of trying to fix things up after they move out because they've wrecked the security deposits, never even come close to the cost of fixing the stuff. And you know, there's all reasons why a person's raising the rent. So much is great, I understand that, but some of us are really struggling when people move out, they destroy things so much. That's what all I got to say about it.
Well, and Chris, before you go, though, I've heard landlords, like anybody else who's doing any construction-related project, they're in some cases facing higher costs of raw materials or labor. Is that part of your story when you're trying to fix up?
Yes, absolutely. The price of lumber is skyrocketed, and labor's went up, but very little for my neck of the woods, at least. I feel sorry for my renters because the wages have been stagnant. That's why I'm trying not to raise my rent, but it's pretty hard. You know, I'm trying to make a profit, not trying to make a killing, but I'm trying to make somewhat of a profit to put in my pocket. I'm taking risks like any other business owner.
Chris, thanks for sharing your story. Andy, I think that's especially maybe for smaller landlords, this is going to be a pretty common story that material costs, labor costs are leading them to want to or to have to increase rent, as Chris said, even though he doesn't really want to.
That's part of this storm. Chris sounds like the kind of landlord we need more of, to be honest. I don't know how to explain people trashing apartments. That makes no sense to me. I think the relationship that people forge as landlords and tenant does not have to be adversarial. We're all people. We may all be bozos on the same bus listening to the same music. But the reality is, can we work together to make things unfold positively? And if people are trashing your homes and you have to spend money to get them back in shape and rent them, that's a totally understandable form of rent increase. And I don't have an answer for human imperfection. I just think if there's relationships, positive relationships established, we have a better chance of getting through this together. I've seen landlords go to bat for vulnerable tenants with disabilities or barriers to communication where they've waited and waited to collect their rent so that they could access the rent assistance programs that were out there because they believed in them and wanted to keep them in housing. I would guess that in those kinds of cases, those renters are unlikely to trash an apartment, but it's an interesting world.
Thanks for sharing your story. We're talking to Andy Height. Andy's the Housing Policy and Program Manager with the Wisconsin Community Action Program. With us today to look at what's causing rent to increase in Wisconsin, what that means for housing affordability in communities around the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing a big share of your income, more than you'd like, go toward rent? Has rent gone up for you? Maybe created a tough situation figuring out where you're going to live after the lease expires. If you own properties that you rent out, what do you see driving the costs for you? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look now at the rising cost of rent in Wisconsin, looking at why it's getting higher, what renters can do. Andy Height is with us from the Wisconsin Community Action Program. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had a tough time finding affordable housing, rent, or if you're looking to buy a house for that matter, because that is part of the story, or if you've been successful. Rents are reasonable in your neck of the woods. Love to hear from you. If you rent to others, what is driving your costs right now? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Andy, for somebody in a housing crisis situation right now, their lease is ending, say, and they can't afford that higher rent now, they don't have a place, or maybe even somebody who's facing high costs of owning a house, what kind of resources are out there? What are some first steps they could take?
The first step, if you're seeking housing, I would start at your local community action agency. You can go to WISCAP, WISCAP.org, and find, look at the map for Wisconsin Emergency Rent Assistance and find the agency administering the program in your area and ask about housing navigation. If you need emergency rent assistance, you can call the local agencies directly because they can hook you up with all of the other anti-poverty programs they're running, or you can call our partner at Energy Services, who's running the statewide rent assistance hotline at 833-900-9372. The last thing I'll mention, Rob, if you are a homeowner and it's your primary residence and you're in financial crisis because of the pandemic, you've lost your job or you lost hours and you're behind on your mortgage or your taxes or your utilities or some combination, you can apply for the just launched today at 1 o'clock by Governor Evers, the Wisconsin Help for Homeowners program. Go to Home Ownership Help. That's homeownershiphelp.wisconsin.gov. That's homeownershiphelp.wi.gov, not the full spelling of Wisconsin. Sorry about that. There are resources out there. If you're in a house, we want to do everything we can to keep people in those homes. There just isn't enough permanent affordable housing, Rob, and we need to see the state, counties, municipalities, towns, cities invest with in partnership with nonprofits in permanent affordable housing. You hear needs for workforce housing. You hear needs for affordable housing from the most rural communities to the most urbanized communities and everywhere in between. And if we don't make a concerted effort in investing in this infrastructure, we are just delaying what's going to be a major crisis. Permanent affordable housing is critical to everyone's quality of life, but especially young children and people in vulnerable situations who might have disabilities, mobility issues, cognitive issues, things that just make the day-to-day challenges of this world more difficult. So how do we come together with the sense of neighborhood and community to keep people in their homes while expanding the options? It's not going to be easy in this divide and conquer time, but I think it's a must that we devote time, attention, and resources to it.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Courtney is with us in Green Bay. Courtney, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Courtney?
Well, I'm going to say that I'm on both sides of the perspective here, because I have worked for landlords, some big companies that own a lot of stuff here in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And there's two sides of the story. Yes. Do landlords get screwed over when tenants move out? Do they trash the place, and did they lack care and detail while living in there? Absolutely. I see that and I understand that. But the cost isn't as high as what they're explaining. And their loans have been their loans. Their interests have been their interests. And at the end of the day, they are still making money. So that's kind of iffy and a joke on it to jump your rent so significantly high. Because I'm a single mom and I work really hard and I rent. And I worked for these landlords. And so for me to see, and I also am in the same boat. I paid $955 for a 3-bedroom, 1-bath duplex, and now it's jumping as well. So if you look at the whole big spectrum, I think some people are using this as an excuse to raise the rent to bring more revenue in. Because at the end of the day, these banks are not increasing their interest rates. They're not increasing the loan amount. So they're still making the same amount of profit.
Gotcha.
So that's kind of...
Courtney, thanks for the call. Courtney sees kind of both sides there. Andy, can we dial down the sort of assumption of an adversarial relationship? Should we dial that down?
I think that The first option is to always figure out how to work together. There is no doubt. I would imagine, because of Courtney's experience as a tenant and as a property manager, that Courtney doesn't leave units trashed when she leaves. There is normal wear and tear that happens. I think anyone who rented in a college town knows that no matter how pristine you may leave a unit, the landlord finds a way to take money from their security deposit. It just seemed like a fact of life for people I knew in places like Madison or Milwaukee or Oshkosh or in other states with college towns. And it's just a challenge. How do you establish a relationship when there's a power imbalance? Some people have a better knack for that than others. And once it becomes adversarial, it's very hard to win a power struggle with somebody who is the owner if you're the renter. So how do we avoid it? And again, I think it comes with communication styles and communication willingness in terms of both parties. And that's way easier said than done.
Courtney, thanks for sharing your unique perspective. Talking to Andy Hyde from the Wisconsin Community Action Program, talking about the high cost of rent in Wisconsin. Back to your calls now. Nancy is on the line in Milwaukee. Nancy, hello.
Hey, Nancy.
Hello to you. My comment is that I own and live in a very large duplex. I've lived here 46 years. The last time I tried to rent the very large upstairs apartment, a woman and two men came. The woman was married to one man, and she said the other man was his brother. So while I was showing her this very large kitchen, and she was telling me how nice it was, I heard the two brothers say to each other, "We could get five sets of bunk beds. These bedrooms are so large." In other words, the brother of the husband was planning on moving his family in too. But, of course, they didn't tell me that. It was just the man and the woman making an application. But when I heard the brother say, "Well, we can get five sets of bunk beds in here," I thought to myself, that's all I need is 10 children in an upstairs apartment. So I think a lot of families are going to have to double up because of the high rents. And it is pathetic that our government is not providing housing for returned veterans and for young couples.
Nancy, I got you. We don't have too much time left. Nancy's seeing pressure maybe for big groups of people to go into smaller places than they normally would because of those high rents, Andy.
Sounds like a terrible situation. I don't know. Again, human imperfection is a unique thing, and it's very important to artistic processes, but it makes the tenant-landlord relationships very difficult at times. So I guess how you screen, and when somebody says that, I think it's an important thing to say, well, I'm only renting to the people on, you know, this lease. Who's going to be in here? And, you know, next, please, because I imagine a unit of the quality that Nancy was renting would have a fairly high demand for it. So I've empathized with every caller so far today.
Nancy, thanks for that call. Less than a minute left, Andy. Magic wand, what would be your number one thing to lower rents?
Number one thing is more permanent, affordable housing with either a tax credit program or a voucher program where people only have to pay 30% of their income to rent. I think we move away from Section 8 vouchers and towards tax credit vouchers like the child care tax credit that was recently undone by the Senate, where eligible people would have that increment of rent paid directly to the landlord on a monthly basis, right to their savings account. And that might be a way to expand, to keep people in housing while we put our heads down and figure out how to collaborate on expanding the options of permanent affordable housing around the state.
Andy, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Andy Hyde is a housing policy and program manager with the Wisconsin Community Action Program with us today to talk about the rising cost of rent in Wisconsin and what that means for low and middle income renters. By the way, we've got some of the reference info that he mentioned to find info about rent assistance. We've got a link up at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to an expert on international relations about the humanitarian crisis being created by Russia's war in Ukraine and concerns about what the fighting means for Ukrainian nuclear power plants. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.